Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 21st, 2006. Our session today is Mastering Flexible Intercultural Communication. Our presenter is Jeff Kressengreep, session number KGJ 2006-5. Let's listen in.
This is session 5 of 5. This is my last teaching session here in Holden Village, and all of these have been sessions about navigating the ship. They aren't about docking in particular ports. You're not going to learn a lot about a particular culture by paying attention today or to any of the other days, but that I'm hoping what you'll learn and what I learned by teaching this is the things I can safely ignore when I'm crossing cultural boundaries of all types, and the things that I really can't safely ignore, the things that I have to pay attention to and have to see that are going on. If I'm going to have something other than a violent encounter or an unproductive encounter or even what's called a well-meaning clash with people from another culture, I really have to pay attention to certain things. And today's session really is focused on... Oh, are you starting, Quentin?
Yes.
Figure this out? Okay, thank you. They record this stuff, and I always forget to say, please start now. But today's session is really about... this is where rubber is meeting road. So what do you actually do when you find yourself crossing some sort of cultural boundary? What are some general guidelines that you might apply? This could be like the ship pilot manual. The things that you could have in mind. We've been talking about more specific things, more targeted things in other sessions this week, and this is where it all kind of ties up today, is to think about what sorts of things are really present. The sessions I've been doing here have been pretty interactive. I'm asking you to speak again today with somebody who's near you, who's preferably not a family member, or somebody you're married to, but that you'd talk with one other person a couple different times today, starting in just a minute. And we'll be done in an hour with hopefully some new resources, and we'll probably generate more questions than we'll generate answers. But I want to offer you some resources, see what you think of them, and try them out. One other thing I'd say before we launch into this stuff is to think about cultures not as nations necessarily, but that I like to think of even my marriage as an intercultural communication event that is kind of ongoing. I was raised, you know, in a relatively masculine way, and she was raised in a relatively feminine way, and that means we often use different symbols and interpret the same symbols differently often, the same acts differently. And so a lot of the advice that might be applied to, say, being effective in Swaziland might also mean to being effective on Chestnut Street in Vancouver, Washington, and you can apply some of the same principles. If they don't work, they don't work, but you know, it helps sometimes to think of not everything as intercultural communication, but look for cultural and not just personal reasons why you might be having difficulties. I've had this little example up here. This caught my eye a couple of years ago in the New Zealand Herald. A teenage girl who was deceased and then betrothed to the King of Swaziland. As far as I know, it actually went through. I think she is now one of his wives. But what I'd like to have you do, please, is introduce yourself to somebody who's near you if you don't know them. Just introduce them by name. And kind of back there, you might have to talk to each other. What I'd like to have you do is, would you talk to each other about what you think you would do if you had some power to do anything in this situation? What do you think should be done? What do you think should be done? So say hello, greet the other person by name, talk about what you think should be done. We'll do just 5 minutes of this. Okay, ladies and gentlemen. I'm interested now. You don't have to disclose what it is that you would have done in that situation had you had some power, but which of these strategies did you identify, which of these assumptions did you see in any of the strategies that you came up with? There's no shame in living out your culture as you're coming up with a strategy. This isn't, you did it wrong. Yeah. Good.
It seems like, we're making an assumption that something needs to be done, and I'm wondering if anyone has asked the girl whether she wants to be there.
Okay. Others? You know, that conversation.
One, two, three, and six.
Okay. Which one in particular really stood out in the strategy you chose or considered?
Well, that there could be a resolution where the implementation would take care of itself. Number six.
Okay.
That was clear, but I also think that the number two, self-disclosure, open self-disclosure, an open process. I'd abolish Swaziland and return it to the Republic of South Africa. Yeah. So I guess that involved number three, too.
Okay.
Heather, go ahead.
Our solution was assassination.
Number three, immediacy directs the assassinates. Kill the guy. At least the mall.
You assumed that they were killing the mall.
Pardon?
You assumed they were killing the king. They might have been saying they'd assassinate the mom, and then that would eliminate the
mall. No. Oh, I got thoughts.
We too talked about, you know, is this even something that, you know, we're approaching it from our culture, and maybe it's an honor in that culture. You know, maybe I mean, in this particular case, the mother was not in agreement, but maybe that's an honor, and to live in the palace is not that bad. But we talked also that probably number three, some sort of action, you know, if that was our child that had got abducted, yeah. What can we do? Yeah. We got to go in there and do something.
This is the one I have the hardest time with these two. Being raised as a U.S. American man, rationality should win. Don't be emotional on me. You know, let's talk when you're calm.
Sure, that's popular.
Yeah, that works really well. And when somebody says no or somebody says yes and then they go back on it, I get really self-righteous. But you said yes. You know, and that's my feeling. I'm thinking, you know, you're just being personally rude or inappropriate or something. But I don't see it as a cultural act. I see it as a personal affront that you did this to me. What responses? Go ahead, Rachel.
Oh, well, I was going to say the first one, because in many cultures, family relationships and family names are so important, and we don't think about that as much. So for me, if the mother is going to say something against the king, she must be very unhappy or crazy, maybe, because to be out front like that in a position to put her family name kind of on the line and to react towards a daughter who might not be as valuable in a different culture is a big deal.
Yeah, one big distinction we talked about between types of cultures is cultures that are individualistic, like U.S. American mainstream culture is, and collectivistic cultures, where it matters a lot more who you came from, and you make a lot more choices involving those people rather than just yourself as an independent actor trying to maximize your own happiness in things. Go ahead.
I think that the other reason the mother was so upset and claimed abduction is that she wasn't paid the price. So if the girl is happy being there and all it takes is pay the mother and give her fair just dues, everybody might be happy. We can leave the nuns at home.
Do you understand the difference between interests and positions before we leave this sheet? Your position is what you want. Your interest is why you want that. So classic example, one orange, two people. Okay, we could just say, you want the orange, so do I. Well, let's cut it in half and each have half an orange. You know, sort of get our positions met. If we find out interests are, I'm baking a cake and I want the rind, and you just wanted a snack, maybe we can both get all of what we want. We can meet all of our interests. But we have positions because we have interests. Our culture, we tend to look for both. In fact, if you read something like, what's it called? Getting to Yes, a really popular negotiation strategy book. It's about this thick, not very thick, four major steps, one of which is see if you can identify interests behind the positions, assuming that they're separable. And that's a very... It's not only an American assumption, but it is an American assumption about conflict, that we can separate those things. And many others, it's messier than that. So I'm bringing up like a conflict situation because those are the hardest. It's coming to Holden is an intercultural communication experience, but it doesn't usually involve conflict. And you don't get off the bus and say hello and somebody says, well, what do you mean? You know, you don't get that. It's a culture based around hospitality. And I think we're most challenged by situations where there is conflict involved and we're expected to do some sort of working out with each other. I'm going to ask you to do just one more thing with this partner today, and this is going to involve a little bit of reflection. I'd like you to, if you could, tell that partner about one encounter that you would identify as an intercultural encounter in the broadest sense. It could be that you find yourself the only man at a baby shower or something, and you were mystified by something that went on. But if you could recount an incident where things didn't go as well as you thought they could have, that you were trying to have an interaction with somebody from a culture that wasn't exactly your culture and you were dissatisfied to some degree, not entirely dissatisfied, but things just didn't go quite as well as they could have with that other person. So you can come up with something and then just tell the partner as much about it as you want to, just a little bit, to bring it to mind. Do you have questions about this one? This is the hardest thing I've asked you to do so far.
Yeah.
give this about 3 or 4 minutes. I promise I will give you back. In case you're curious and you're kind of eager to get to content, we'll get there. I tend to teach kind of bass-ackwards, that it's why the editor of our university's magazine just assigned me, he said, write 1,000 words on learning to shut up. And he's convinced that's what I do. He's convinced that's why I'm a good teacher, is because I do more inhaling than exhaling. What we're doing today is kind of an inductive process where we start with your experiences and then we'll interpret your experiences through a variety of kind of lenses that are traditionally applied to this stuff, so you get kind of a personal sense of what this means. That's the goal. Or you might just walk out saying, wow, that was really dumb. Glad he's done. You know, that kind of response. I asked Brett or Susan, could you share an example of this? I know these guys have been everywhere, so they can probably have examples of the one time things didn't go perfectly.
Well, just one nostalgic, crazy one. We were laughing about, we were partner pastors in Cape Town, South Africa, and in our one of our congregations, every time you think church council meetings are frustrating sometimes here, when cultures really clash. So the last two on that list, no is no and yes is yes, and you think when you decide something, the implementation will follow.
Just follow,
yeah. Vote on something in church council and come back the next month, and it's all up for renegotiation and stuff like that. But here and now, I was just thinking of two good friends that we have. I mean, they're good friends. They're from Asian countries, and just going out to dinner sometimes can be, the conversation can just, there's still lots of things that catch me off guard. And especially, I think yesterday, we were talking about face.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We'll talk a little more about that today.
Yeah, and a lot of that, about being right and wrong and whether have a safe face. And, just things that seem to jump out and bite me, even after I think I'm more in tune, and then, yeah, just a little bit.
One of the things, thank you, one of the things I point out about, especially the dinner story, is that a lot of this stuff happens just breath to breath. It's not like a whole day's worth of mistakes.
Yeah.
It's like you do an utterance and you realize, that was bad. Oh, here comes, oh, geez, now I got, oh, how do I do that? Oh, it's just this whole series of little interactions. And you know that just as each one could make it worse, also another breath could make it better. You know, and that's the key. But we're not talking about macro level stuff here. We're talking about little tiny things that we do with each other and how we catch what it is that we're doing. I'd like you to look at, if you don't mind, you've all got these little stories in mind now. Here are four components of actually communicating competently across cultures. What I'd like you to do, I'm going to have three of these slides. And on the first slide, what I want you to do is to identify to yourself and then ultimately with your partner, which of these four pieces do you think was most responsible for the discord, for the thing that didn't work? Was it the motivations of the people involved? This, by the way, is key. If you aren't at all interested in communicating across cultural boundaries, that is enough to not do it well. But you got to want to, or else you can't. So was it a motivational issue? Somebody really wanted to communicate with you. You didn't want to communicate with them. Knowledge, either about intercultural communication or about particular cultures, they're called, we've been using the iceberg metaphor, kind of popular artifacts, rituals, popular myths. Ours has, for example, the underdog myth to the David and Goliath myth. Those are huge myths we use in our own stories in this culture, reinforcing our cultural place. And cultural values kind of at the bottom of the culture. So is it a knowledge issue? Was it an attitude issue? How I feel about the things I'm supposed to know in that culture or the things that people apparently feel in that culture? Was it, did I just have, or the other person have the wrong kind of attitude for things to work? Or was it a skills and abilities issue that I, in fact, was motivated, knew enough, had, you know, attitudes that were probably appropriate, but I was just lacking this last piece. So if you take just a couple minutes to think about that, I'll solicit a couple examples from you and see what you have to say. Ready, go! Okay, who's got a clear sense of one or more of these categories emerging as probably the culprit in the scenario you had? Anybody have a really clear sense? Just raise your hand if you feel like you have a clear sense.
Sense of
which of these it probably was. Okay, Dave, try one.
I was thinking back in high school, when I was going to high school, it was in Seattle, we were really busing and racial intermixing, and after a football game at the Seattle Center, kind of guys from Black School, one guy from Black School, my couple of friends, trying to pick a fight. Mm-hmm. And as I look back on that, it was a very frightening culture for me to be involved with, because I don't like to fight and rumble. Mm-hmm. And I look back, and I think the guys were looking for awesome energy after the game. So I think motivations was a big...
Sounds like it to me. Yeah. Didn't get past that point. Anybody else clear about one that wasn't motivations? Stephanie?
I was volunteering with a group of students from the University of Portland.
Sorry, where did you graduate from?
University of Portland.
Yeah, congratulations.
And professor, do you have any professors we know?
I actually didn't have any professors.
We met in a stairwell once and we were both wearing a Holden thing, so we stopped and looked.
And I was volunteering with a big group of students and got to know all of them pretty well. And one of them was from Southeast Asia. And I wasn't even aware of this kind of problem at all, but I was just joking around with him and patting him on the head. And he was like, oh, that, like, he told me that that is not acceptable and that it wasn't appropriate and everything. And I was, like, really caught off guard because it was knowledge. It just wasn't.
Great. So how did he tell you? I mean, can you model it for us?
Like, well, I was just, like, I patted him on the head. I like, told a joke or something. And he was like, oh, Stephanie, that's, like, in my culture, that's not, like, appropriate to do. And that's kind of, like, putting me lower than you really liked. Like, if we're, like, on the same level, that shouldn't be. And I was aware, like, he said it nicely, but I was kind of like, what do I say now? I apologized, and then I was like, could you tell me why? Or
did he physically flinch or anything?
Yeah, he did. Mm-hmm.
Great, so notice that these cultural things aren't just things that live here. They live here. You know, when they're violated, you feel it. You know, you get touched inappropriately or culturally inappropriately.
Well, and
that was knowledge, yes. Right?
And I understand that in the Korean War and in the Vietnamese War, that was a problem because the U.S. soldiers would want to pat the kids on the head. You know?
We're having trouble in Iraq now, too, that yes. the preferred hold is to put your foot on someone's neck when they're on the ground. That's how soldiers are trained to restrain people that are restrained. And the sole of your foot is the most offensive. I mean, this dust is just a random gesture. But to them, it's this. I mean, it's a terrible gesture to do, and that our soldiers are trained to do the most offensive thing in their cultural code to everybody they detain doesn't help us win hearts and minds. How about attitude or skills? Go ahead,
Aaron. Mine is actually a combination of those two.
Okay.
I do web development for TLU, and part of my job is to talk to faculty members who have a need or a project and do it. And it's many of them are much older than I am. And so it can be very difficult. First of all, there's the skills and abilities. They don't have the knowledge of computers that I've grown up with. And
can I stop you there?
Yeah.
Did you notice the nice face-saving way Aaron put that? He said, they don't have the knowledge of computers that I grew up with. He didn't say that I have. What's the difference between saying knowledge of computers that I have or knowledge of computers that I grew up with?
They didn't have the opportunity.
So it's not that they're stupid. And you're identifying, clearly you're aware that there are people like that in this room, and you were tailoring your message. Here, this has a compliment, Aaron. That was a compliment for careful face work on your part to say, you know, they aren't as smart as I am. You instead attributed your knowledge to, well, I just grew up with it. It's something that I have. Even if that's not true, even if you are just, you know, way smarter on this stuff, the way you chose to phrase the message was a competent message because of the face thing. Okay, so now they have thrown that track.
But yeah, I mean, the hardest part is, I mean, they'll come in and often the way they try to explain to me what they need is difficult. I mean, because they're not quite sure what tools are available, what can be done.
I want that blue thing.
And yeah, and so it's kind of this meandering road where I get little bits of information and I want to take control of the situation and say, so what would you envision the end product be? You know, and ask them questions to elicit responses that I need. And sometimes it doesn't work so well. So I would be in control of the situation. They would be in control of telling me what they need. And that can be accomplished.
Great example. Okay, good. Here's the second slide. Let's look at this now. Same situation. Aside from looking at these things, there's another set of stuff to look at that are all related to communication. When we're talking about competent communication, that sounds like kind of a milquetoasty term, doesn't it? My name is Jeff, and I'm competent. But in communication terms, that's pretty high praise. Competence is what we strive for. And in intercultural terms, these four components are what it means to be competent. So let me tell you what's meant by each of these terms so you can distinguish them. And then I'd ask you to do the same thing with the scenario. Is it a problem of appropriateness, effectiveness, adaptability, or creativity? Appropriateness is how well did the communication that the parties engaged in honor the norms of that sort of interaction? Was it appropriate? The second issue has to do with not how well it fit, but how well it worked. Because you can be effective without being appropriate. You can do things that are way outside the norm and be very effective, or you can be perfectly normal and be ineffective. So they're really two different concerns. If you're looking at communication competence generally, those are the two pieces that are usually meant. Is your communication appropriate to the relationships and the situations involved, the identities involved, and did you get done what you were trying to get done in that situation? We usually assume that communication has a goal behind it. So when you're talking with Jack in registration, you probably went there so you could talk to her about, you know, when you're leaving or something. You wanted to be clear about which bus you wanted to be on, and you wouldn't leave until you accomplished that sort of goal. And so we have that kind of stuff in mind. The other two are kind of unique to intercultural communication. One here is adaptability, which is just what it sounds like. I went in with one idea of how things were going to go. It didn't go that way, so I did this instead. Hey. Okay. This one, I think we all know how to show respect in our own culture. It's important to have cultural knowledge about what counts as respect in another culture, what counts as positive regard for another person. Stephanie, you gave a great example of the, you know, kind of the sign of affection in our culture, just kind of a non, doesn't really mean anything one way or the other. But to know that's disrespectful in another culture, that's important to know. What are the ways we show respect in U.S. American mainstream culture? What are the things that, when you know you're being respected, what do people do?
Listen to you.
Okay, what is that?
Listen when you talk.
But what does that mean? What does that behaviorally mean? How do you know when you're being listened to?
You're not being heard.
Okay, they let you speak. What else?
Eye contact.
Okay, good eye contact. Is that what you had in mind?
Yeah.
Because okay. I'm listening to you like this.
Yeah.
I can still hear you. Is that what you mean?
No, it's a body language thing and an eye contact.
Okay, so we're supposed to look. Other things? How else do you know when you're being respected?
Some kind of verbal response.
That's relevant to what you were saying?
That it's been heard.
Okay.
If you're meeting somebody for the first time, you're shaking your hand versus, you know, standing very stoic.
Or at least reciprocating whatever gesture you get.
Right.
Somebody holds out their hand, it's disrespectful not to engage that hand. It's a statement, right? You just sort of look at the hand, talk to the hand. All right, so we have knowledge of how to do this in our own culture. Sometimes it's mystifying when people don't feel respected by that same stuff in other cultures. Kind of difficult. Adaptability, can you adapt, again, appropriately to particular situations? Not more than just a frame of reference. This gets down to more of a micro level. Can you actually, that little phrase I tried didn't work, or I spoke it too soon after the other phrase, or I wasn't looking at you long enough, or I mean, can you be adaptable even at those little micro level things? Sensitivity, much like respect, sensitivity and empathy vary across culture too. How do you demonstrate empathy in this U.S. American culture? How do you know when someone's being empathic with you? Okay, sometimes physical touch.
Nodding your head.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Facial expressions.
Facial expressions like what, Dave?
Usually sorrow or empathy, but that's not helpful. Some sort of emotional response through facial expression.
Okay, so you aren't stoic. You animate in ways that are consistent with the partner's language and story.
With respect to adaptability and sensitivity and respect, East Asians will frequently bow, and you'll find yourself responding if you're paying attention. Or it makes you very uncomfortable. Kind of guidance. Put that away.
The discomfort or the reciprocation? What should you put away?
I would put away the discomfort. Mm-hmm.
Although I've heard from several Japanese students and other Japanese cultural members over the years that if you're visiting Japan and you're not a Japanese culture, you really shouldn't try and bow.
No, I'm thinking about them here.
Right. But that there's so many nuances to bowing appropriately that it can result in huge face loss for the other person as you're bowing lower, holding it a certain length of time. Who bows first? How low do you bow? What do you do with the rest of your body when you bow? Who comes up first? And if you do it wrong, or you got to do it again? You know, it just becomes a real hard ritual to manage unless you know exactly how to do it. So sometimes it's great just to, just be the foreigner, you know, hello, nice to meet you. And you do the thing you're expected to do.
We have, and this goes back to knowledge, we have a Japanese exchange student one summer, and my thought was, she came in the summer, when she got there we'd have the all-American barbecue.
Oh!
Well, you do not show your teeth, evidently, while you're eating.
Oh, no.
And I served corn on the cob. So I was not only didn't have the knowledge and I didn't have the sensitivity to apply that, but she adapted really well because she just took each individual kernel off like that and ate it.
Really?
And of course she probably thought we were like animals because we were all eating our corn on the cob. But she very, you know, daintily just took each kernel off. But I thought, after I found this out about halfway through the visit.
So there she is.
She was creative.
She was being creative, yeah. Like, well, I guess this is what Americans do. Well, you should have done a stir fry then with those little baby corns in it.
Yeah.
So she'd do the same with those.
That would have kept her busy.
But these seven are a nice little template. If you can think about, you could probably just reflect later on today if you can bring to mind again the scenario you brought up for yourself about when things didn't work so well. You might be able to look at this list and think, oh, I bet it was this and maybe that. Mm-hmm. And that if I had done this in a different way or maybe shown empathy in that way, we would have had a more satisfying encounter. So I find these seven to be really nicely helpful around here. There are some things that are unique about U.S. culture that make it a little harder for us to do the things that we need to do. I like this model. It's an older model, but it makes some sense about how we get more competent interculturally. It's a predictable way to go. We go from being unconsciously incompetent. We're just floating happily along, you know, bending left and right, being effective, less effective than we could be. And then we move to, it's not working. And then you move to the very awkward conscious competence stage where you're trying things, but you're very aware that you're trying them. It's like learning to ride a bike, and you're aware of every little shift of the handlebars and all that stuff, and you think, is it going to be like this forever? No, it's not. Eventually, it gets to be like riding a bike, where you don't get on and think about every move. It becomes more second nature to do that sort of thing. You move to your unconscious again, but it's competence this time. But you do have to kind of pull it up from the back of your head. I don't know why I've always had this image, but like a window shade. Mm-hmm. That's always kind of rolled up in the back of your head and working just fine. But to learn this stuff, you kind of have to unroll it, you know, and look at it, and, you know, kind of examine it, and then let it go back there again and become unconsciously competent. And we do that a little bit different. One of the values we've been talking about this week in U.S. culture is that we tend to value competition is often at the heart of what it means to be American. In fact, especially masculine American, if you're a guy and you don't want to keep score playing sports, you don't ever want to keep score.
I don't even want to keep score.
But that's certainly an anti-masculine, but really an anti-American critique too. We're raised not just to compete, but to believe in competition, to really venerate competition. We do it in our classrooms, we eat bugs on TV, we do all sorts of things. Things are much more fun for us if there's a competition involved. Sam was involved in a really fun water fight about an hour ago. And the first thing I heard from five or six of the people independently after the water fight was, we won. We kicked them. And they had a great time. You know, it was really fun. And it set some things up as contests. But some of the critics of the culture say this leads us not necessarily to excellence in intercultural communication. We tend to be swimming upstream if we're doing the non-competitive things that actually get us closer to other people and help us notice things and respond flexibly instead of just asserting ourselves in those situations. Here we're talking about a conflict again, but we're thinking about, this is the phrase that's key here, is relational atmospheres. That is, thinking about how you're picturing the interaction you have with the other person. Are you picturing that as something that's combative, or are you picturing it as something that's cooperative? And it matters what both parties are picturing. The relational atmosphere is something a third party could observe. It's not just your own private perception of what's going on. These are actually research findings based on what we know about how these relationships play out. That if you've got a competitive relational atmosphere, coercion is more likely to happen. You're more likely to try and force things. Deception is also more likely to happen. And just poor communication, just the stuff that's less clear, less effective, less appropriate, less adaptive, less creative. Cooperative atmospheres, on the other hand, tend to promote not real similarity, but perceived similarity. If you're working with someone, you're more likely to, if you're working with someone that you think is similar, I'm sorry, if you're working with someone, you're more likely to see them as worth working with. there's just on this point, as a sidebar, I read a study recently of, it was called What Lovers Can Teach Us About Persuasion, that they were studying married couples and how they persuaded each other to do things. And there were three strategies. One was they'd have married couples come in and they'd have one try and convince the other to do something. And only one of the three strategies actually worked. One strategy involves some kind of coercion. You just don't know. You know, I know better. That one never worked. Another one was the logical one, where one party would try and lay out the evidence for the other party and say, well, you know, remember when this happened? Remember when it happened again? You know, therefore we should really do it this way. That didn't work either. The only strategy that really worked for those couples was one party would do what's called a relationship reminder to the other person. They would say something like, you know, we've been together 23 years now. I'd really like you to do this for me. And that worked like two-thirds of the time. There was something about a relationship reminder, just reminding people, highlighting the places where you're connected rather than the places where you're disconnected, to actually call attention to those places. That's what this means. If you've got a cooperative atmosphere, it makes it easier to find those places and highlight them and create that mutual perception that you have some similarities, that you aren't just different. You're more similar than different. Yes, I did. So if you're working cross-culturally and you're trying for this sense of cooperation rather than competition, you have to kind of have that early on. It helps to have it early on. And that means you set up an atmosphere of exploration rather than kind of trying not to use the words rhetorical and dialectical. You're setting up a situation where the people involved are using each other as resources rather than aiming stuff at each other as targets. How's that? We did a forum on Monday night about competition, and I heard from two different people on my way up the hill afterwards that it felt like people were trying to work things out with each other in the forum, that comments were building on other comments. It felt like people were coming to different understandings of the idea based on what other people were saying. I facilitated other forums up here where people kind of come in and speak their piece and then sit down and cross their arms. You know, and that's, you just sort of like a cartoon gunfight going on. This is the opposite of that, that you're trying to set up the other person and yourself as resources for each other. You're communicating across a cultural boundary you're not understanding very well, ask a lot. Find out what's going on instead of feeling like you have to figure it all out on your own. Was that you we heard on the microphone? Michael?
At first. Yeah.
At first, very nice. And then? Was it you?
No, she was in the
We had celebrities. Okay, so exploration is important to setting up that cooperative atmosphere so you can do something to jumpstart the cooperation. It's not that we're stuck without it. And actually, you can do it in ways that are culturally appropriate. You wouldn't get labeled un-American, for example, for soliciting this from other people. And this I find really hard, but it's necessary. If you can stop the judgment long enough to really try and figure out what's going on with the other person. And if I'm committed to the process, I'm more likely to be in on the solution as well. Earlier that one of the ways, one of the things that we use to divide up different kinds of cultures are this notion of individualistic and collectivistic. We're a very individualistic culture. Now, there are other cultures more individualistic than U.S. American mainstream culture, but we are one of them. And so when you find yourself trying to manage a difficult situation across cultural boundaries, there are three things that can really help if you're doing this. We talked yesterday about face and face saving, how you do things to be cognizant of how other people want to be seen in an interaction. I'm telling you right now, I've been telling you all hour how I want to be seen, and you've been telling me, even though you're very quiet, telling each other, you know, how you want to be seen. You're competent to the degree that you can recognize how the other person wants to be seen and that you can respond mindfully to that. I mean, you can challenge it, of course, if you think they're wanting to be seen in a way that's inappropriate. But to be aware at that level makes you more competent rather than less. So one of the ways that if you're an individualist, collectivist cultures think a lot about face. We don't think a lot about face. It matters to us, but it's not a priority. If you want to communicate well with somebody from a collectivist culture, it's important to have that in mind, to make face saving a priority when you're thinking about what should I say and do here. really prioritize that, making sure there's the appearance of harmony and not that you're not going to shame anybody inadvertently if you can help it. So thinking about humiliation, respect, shame, and honor, and really looking for those possibilities and the things that you might do, and try and take the route that's safest in light of those things. Second, I'm always tempted to ask a lot of why questions, because I'm really curious about stuff, and that's kind of a cultural characteristic of Americans. Well, now, why is that? You know, it's a very American kind of question, and often that works against us when we're dealing across with a collectivistic boundary. And being more patient, less immediate, less hasty, less assassination-minded, as we had in the Swazi example. Mindful observation. We're also not that comfortable with silence, right? We tend to fill it. I tend to fill it. I thought it was funny that the university's magazine editor asked me to write 1,000 words on learning to shut up. You know, people who've had me as a teacher would not say that I shut up. I do inhale a lot in the classroom, but I don't shut up a lot. So this is a challenge for me. And this practicing mindful listening skills, that means not just letting sounds bounce off eardrums, but actually soliciting information from the other party.
Jeff?
Yeah?
Is that, I don't understand the humiliation and the price.
Yeah, I'm not sure I do either. I don't know why I put price up there.
Is that supposed to be pride?
You might be. Maybe it's just a typo. But the point is to think about those to a greater degree than we think about them in our home culture. Yeah, but it's less important to be clear than it is to take care of those relationships and to be wary of where you might humiliate someone, disrespect them, shame them somehow, and not knowing that you're going to. Again, Stephanie, your example is a great one. And then if you happen to be crossing the other way, for example, feminine culture in the U.S. is a more collectivistic culture than masculine culture is. If you find yourself having a hard time arguing with somebody who was raised in a more individualistic way, you might have to teach yourself to use more assertive conflict behavior, stating a clear thesis. You know, here's what I think is right, or here's what I want. That's very challenging for people from collectivistic societies often. And then develop some key points systematically. Use some I statements. Ask more why questions. Engage in active listening skills. That's in both. Don't rely solely on nonverbal signals or on other people to gauge personal reactions. In a high context culture, that's what we talked about yesterday, you're expected to just pay attention to who's there and to read into things like body language and how people are standing and who spoke last and how much silence there's been, all those kinds of things. The suggestion here is that you not rely on that sort of stuff quite as much in these conflict situations, but that you verbalize more of that stuff. You act in a more low context way to get those things to happen. I feel like I'm just exhaling a lot here, and we do have a little time left, so let's talk.
Can you say more about why questions? I mean, in the two parts you talked about, using them or not using them, why do people use why questions?
Using why questions, if you're...
Can you use that on, actually?
Yeah, are you taking notes?
Yeah.
Wow.
She's going to do well on the test.
If I'm asking you a lot of why questions, if I'm an individualist and you're a collectivist and I'm asking you a lot of why questions, that may force you or put you in an uncomfortable spot where you actually have to start explaining some of the relationships or explaining the ways that you might feel humiliated about something if I did it a certain way. And even the act of having to explain it kind of puts you in just an insufferable bind. It makes things a lot harder. So sometimes you have to just sort of process the why in your head without asking the other person, because it kind of puts them on the spot and forces them to explain things that you would be better off just noticing. And it makes it more likely that they'll suffer some kind of face loss in the situation.
So doesn't it also then have a power position?
Say more.
I mean, when I'm asking why, it tends to put you lower than me. Mm-hmm.
You're forced
support.
To explain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was my example from earlier, was that I worked with a group of international interns, and so it wasn't me in another culture or me responding to one person. It was like eight different cultures around a table trying to interact. And because I'm curious and because I'm very straightforward, I was really curious to hear people's different cultural understandings of different issues that we were talking about, religious, and one that came up was death, you know, and I was really curious, and so I kept asking people questions, and they just shut down, some people started crying, and I was like, what
really?
Just happened here, because I was I thought, you know, this is interesting, like, let's share and let's talk, and I was so curious to ask these questions, but, so some people said, you know, we only talk about that one-on-one with people we know very well. You know, these are things we don't talk about in groups, we don't talk about in public. Other people were offended that I asked questions about something sensitive. So those kind of things, that makes a lot of sense to me now. I mean, we had that experience.
Did they tell you that stuff in the moment, or did they tell you
no,
later?
No, they just shut down. Some of them started crying.
But
so
later, when did you learn the stuff you just told
later,
us?
Later, okay. Like months later.
Some patients. Great example. Thank you for sharing it.
In the sales industries, you're talking in sales skills, we avoid the word why because it's confrontational. So we'll use things like, help me to understand, soften the thing out so that it isn't a, well, why do you think that? Like,
well,
you idiot, don't you understand? Kind of.
Yeah, and that gets back to the notion of exploration, helping to understand. I mean, that phrase in and of itself is the same as asking why, but it promotes a more cooperative atmosphere. You're saying, help me understand. And if that's really what you want, you know, then that's also a cooperative attitude and can help you get across that boundary. Our time is up. I hope you have lots of questions in your head. These are people who live with you in the village, and you should talk to them some more. Thanks for this week. It's been really fun to be able to talk about this stuff. This is my favorite stuff to teach, so